Should voting be required as a civic duty? Listen as Brookings Senior Fellows Bill Galston and E.J. Dionne discuss the argument in their new paper, The Case for Universal Voting, Why Making Voting a Duty Would Enhance Our Elections and Improve Our Government.
Thanks, Fred. You know, E.J., there's a question I've been wanting to ask you for a long time. When you heard that I was thinking about writing a paper on universal voting, you came rushing to my office and said, could we write it together? And it really struck me. What made you so enthusiastic about this topic?
Well, I've been a fan of universal voting for a long time. At first, I think, comes from a real affection for and interest in Australian politics. And my friends Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein, friends of yours also, the three of us have spent a lot of time down in Australia. And the first thing that's clear about this is that it works in Australia. It works well in Australia. And watching Australian elections, you could see a number of things that, you know, this solves a lot of problems simultaneously. We worry about the role of money in politics. Universal compulsory voting gets rid of massive expenditures for voter turnout. More importantly, universal voting changes the assumptions of public policy and assumptions about what public officials do. Because if everyone is required to live up to their obligation to vote, then election officials and the law itself has to make it possible for people to live up to that obligations. We have some of the most cumbersome laws on voter registration. We actively make it difficult for people to vote, and some jurisdictions of late have made it even more difficult for people to vote. If we had universal voting, we would suddenly flip the assumptions and say the job of an election official is to help Americans do their duty as citizens. And that, to me, is the most exciting prospect. So that, you know, and the last point is the obvious one, and I want you to talk about that a bit, which is there is a need, I think, to talk, A, about the obligation of citizens to our republic, and B, the fact that our democracy is better when it is based on the attitudes of all Americans and not a tiny subset of Americans or a relatively small subset of Americans who go cast ballots. And so what I want to toss back to you is a lot of people will see this as a way of making it easier for and more likely that lower-income people will participate in voting. And that's almost certainly true, especially if you change the election laws to take into account people's work schedules and like. But one of the things that interested you in this is that you saw it as a way of reducing political polarization and strengthening the forces in the middle of the electorate. Why would this do that?
Boy, that's absolutely right, EJ, and that's a major motive for my interest in this topic. I don't think it's exactly a secret to very many Americans that our political system has been gridlocked for a long time. It's had a harder and harder time getting the basics done, let alone the things that really need to be done for the future. And one of the reasons for that is that when people show up to vote, they are much more likely to be committed partisans of one party or another or ideologically well-defined as liberals or conservatives than are the people who don't show up to vote. And if you get more of the less committed people into the voting pool casting their votes, those people are going to be more open, first of all, to arguments because they haven't made up their minds. And secondly, there's evidence that people who are less committed are also more eager for their representatives in Washington just to roll up their sleeves and get down to work and get the people's business done. But let me add one point. You said that you've seen Australia and it works. And let me just give a little bit of history around that proposition because you're absolutely right. In the early and mid-1920s, Australian political parties across the board got really worried about the state of Australian democracy because the rate of voter participation in national elections had fallen below 60%. frequently in the United States, that's been more like a ceiling than a floor lately. And so they got together and decided in some cases to sponsor and in other cases not to obstruct a law that made voting a civic duty and enforced that duty with the equivalent of a traffic fine. And in the very first election after that new law was passed, participation rose from 59% to 91%. It's been below 90% in only one national election since 1926. And in the election since the Second World War, participation has averaged between 94 and 95%. So universal voting is more than a slogan. It's a reality. And Australians have taken it upon themselves to view voting now as a civic duty. They take it for granted. It's not a big deal. It's not an imposition. There aren't people marching in the streets to abolish it. It's just part of the civic culture. It would not have been without the passage of this law almost a century ago.
Yeah, and I'm glad you sort of underscored that what we are talking about in our paper, what the Australians do, and some other countries have also made this system work. You know, we are not talking about draconian penalties if people don't vote. We're talking about a fine. And I think that it's about as much about sending a signal about the obligations of citizenship as it is about sort of having some sort of deep compulsion here by the state. And the other aspect of this that we talked about a lot and I think is worth sharing on a podcast is why do we use the term universal instead of compulsory? And we make the point in the paper that we are not evading what we are up to here. We understand that, yes, there would be a fine paid if you didn't vote. But we're not interested in this because we like compulsion. We're interested in this because we would like broader participation in American elections. And so we have put this idea out there partly to expand the conversation about what might we do to make participation in our democracy more universal. And you know, I'd like you to talk about this too, what we have in mind, knowing that our idea is not about to be adopted by all 50 states in the union. We'd love to see some states try it. And there are states with high levels of participation, same-day voter registration, where this idea could work very well under pretty much existing laws. But what we'd also like to do is have this be a spur that even if we don't adopt a compulsory voting on the Australian model, we ought to be making it a lot easier for people to vote. We make it very hard for young people to vote in our country. Young people move more, and many of our registration laws make it very difficult on them. Obviously, there's a question of new voter ID laws that have made it difficult for some people to vote. We can make it very hard for people who might move and show up at the wrong polling place on Election Day. There are a whole series of rather simple things. And the commission, the bipartisan commission, and it was really bipartisan that President Obama appointed, suggests a number of simple steps that would make this easier. Shorter lines on Election Day. That commission said people shouldn't have to wait more than a half an hour to vote. And we that's not in a country that has all the technological capability that we have. That's not such a hard thing to do. I mean, where do you see this idea sort of going both in and of itself and as a kind of prod to the political system to try to make participation more universal, whether people buy our idea or not?
Well, the first, in some ways, the best and most important thing that this idea does is to enshrine in law the idea that voting ought to be universal, that our democracy will be stronger, the sense of participation and of ownership of what government does will be much stronger if people are actually involved in choosing the people who make the laws by which they shall be governed. And the point that you made about the civic and moral message of law is really important. We tend to think of law as this heavy cudgel, and people who don't want to do things are beaten into submission by the heavy hand of the law, by draconian fines, etc. One of the things that's most remarkable about the Australian experience is that a little nudge in the direction of civic participation and civic duty. A nudge, the equivalent not even of a moving violation, but an expired parking meter violation, turns out to be enough to transform the electorate of Australia from something like the way the United States voting turnout is now to something more like the norm that as a citizen you should vote and everybody should and nearly everybody does. I think this is remarkable. It's as though the law is pushing on an open door. People just needed a legal reminder to do on a regular basis every time there's a national election what they already know they should do and what they already know there's no particular reason not to do. Yeah, it's harder for some people than others, and I totally agree with you. We ought to be tearing down along the way to universal voting all of the barriers that exist, some by deliberate contrivance and the other by inadvertence and even historical amnesia.
Right. And you know, when you talk about this as a nudge, it's worth for people who say, why do you want to make voting compulsory? It's worth thinking about the fact that in wartime, we actually require people to join the military and risk their lives for their country. Every year, we require a lot of Americans to pay a substantial share of their income in taxes to the government, which the entire government would collapse if people did not voluntarily, but required by law, pay their taxes. It's an interesting metaphor, by the way, because we have, and we should be proud of this as a country, an exceptionally high rate of compliance. Americans cheat on their taxes a whole lot less than other people. But what we are talking about here is a much smaller imposition than those two very large impositions that we take for pretty much for granted.
Let me give you another analogy. We require people to show up for jury duty when called. Jury duty is a lot more demanding than standing in line to vote. Because if you're called for jury duty, it means at the very least half a day or usually a full day of your time before the pool is constituted and you're either impaneled on a jury or dismissed. And we don't think twice about regarding jury duty as a civic duty, not optional. People are warned and then they're fined if they don't show up. And sometimes it's worse than that. So it seems to me that the relationship between voting and jury duty is a very tight one. They are both civic institutions, and they both sustain very important practices that would collapse without public participation.
Right. And there's one other thing, a point we make in the paper, especially at this time of significant alienation from parties, politicians, the government. Under this system, and again, we draw on the Australian model where it works, people don't actually have to vote for anyone. If people really want to cast a blank ballot, want to spoil their ballot, I suppose draw some cartoon character's face on the ballot, they are absolutely free to do that. What they have to do is show up at the polls and take a ballot paper, and they can do what they want with it. So, and that's one of the problems with the terms compulsory voting, which is you can be free not to cast that ballot if you don't want to cast that ballot. But it's got to be a conscious choice, and you still have to perform the act of citizenship of showing up at the polls. And the fact of the matter is, in Australia, most people, knowing that they have a chance to affect the future of their government and knowing that they've gone to the trouble anyway, very few people actually spoil their ballots. But I think it's an important piece of understanding what we are proposing that be required and what is not required here.
Absolutely. And that's another respect, of course, in which it is actually less demanding than jury duty. Because if you're picked for a jury and you're one of 12 men and women tried and true who have to say guilty or not guilty with regard to a specific offense, you have to speak, right? You are compelled to declare yourself. You can't say, I don't know. you really do have to make an affirmation of one sort or another. And we're not requiring that, or at least this proposal wouldn't require that. It means show up at the polls. Take a ballot. What you do with that ballot is between you, your conscience, and your God. But at least you have done your civic duty by showing up.
And you taught me this, in fact, as we were writing the paper, because you had done some research on potential objections to this idea on First Amendment grounds that this was compelled speech. And again, the way compulsory voting works, it is not actually compelled speech, because you are free to be silent if you choose to be with your ballot. It's simply declaring a civic obligation to show up at the polls on election day.
And that's an important point to me, because I'm a strong opponent of compelled speech. And I'm a fervent backer of major Supreme Court cases that have allowed people to refrain from speaking. For example, school children to refrain from repeating the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag on grounds that it violates religious conscience. And so I think that it's one thing to require people to do something. It's a different thing to require people to speak and to affirm something. And we're not doing that.
You know, I think maybe we should close to try to imagine an election day or an election campaign in which this system we're proposing operated. And I just want to sketch out a few things, and maybe you can close on what you think might be different about election campaigns if we had a universal voting system. To me, the first change, which you talked about some at the beginning, is no longer would politicians be making a calculation that, well, my primary job is to turn out my base because all these other people won't vote anyway. Politicians would no longer say, we don't really have to pay attention to young people because young people don't really vote. People don't start voting in large numbers until, you know, they settle down, buy houses or stay in places a long time. Suddenly, young people are a very central part of the political process. And obviously, because of changes, I think this would require to be more sensitive to people's work schedules these days, the politicians would have to talk to, I think, more and more directly to less privileged and lower income people. How do you imagine an election campaign looking different if we had universal voting?
Oh, boy, there are so many changes. I'll just confine myself to a few. First of all, we've developed this elaborate and expensive get-out-the-vote technology. With all sorts of expensive functions that campaigns either have to do themselves or hire professionals to do. Campaigns would have all that money available for activities other than voter mobilization. That's number one. Number two, which I think is very important, a lot of politicians quite cynically use negative campaigns to drive down participation because they've calculated that they'll do better with a smaller electorate. If you know that you can't do that, then your incentive to use pure negativity to drive people out of the electoral process will be very much reduced. And third, there's a fundamental distinction in political campaigns between the mobilization of people who already agree with you, and the only question is whether they'll show up or not, as opposed to the persuasion of people who don't necessarily start out being with you but may be brought over to your side through a combination of self-interest, rightly understood, plus better arguments. And the thought of campaigns that were less about mobilization and more about persuasion, at least to this longtime student of and participation in American politics, is an intensely attractive one. EJ, it's been fabulous writing this paper with you and having a chance to talk about it.
And I feel the same way. I just want to tell you, Bill, that I think you just drew 30 or 40 million Americans to our idea when you said they wouldn't see quite so much nasty stuff on their television sets or coming up in their computers.
Why do you think I said that? I'm trying to persuade them, too.
And I just want to close with three words. They are the first three words of the Constitution of the United States: "We the people." And
that has a
each
nice
of those
ring
words,
to it, doesn't it? Yeah.
It has a good ring. And those three words are important. "We" is something we forget about because we don't have a capacious enough sense right now, a big enough sense that we are a "we." But "we the people" And our idea is to try to say that we, the people, they are not just three great words at the beginning of the Constitution, but they ought to be at the heart of how we run elections and how we govern ourselves. Thank
Amen.
You, Bill.
Amen, brother.